Hi everybody, welcome to this episode of Enlightenment Today. I'm Jason. Today we'll be speaking about karma. Now karma is a term which has become popular within our culture today, where people use karma all the time. They might say, hey man, that was your karma, or that's good karma or bad karma. And people associate karma with cause and effect. But is it really cause and effect? Karma in Sanskrit actually comes from the Sanskrit root kri, which actually means action, literally means action and not cause and effect. So what this means is inherent in action is the results of the future. So it's a yoga of action, which is what karma is, karma yoga. Now we've taken this to mean literally cause and effect, and we've forgot about the action aspect of it. Now what we've done, especially in the West, is we have superimposed karma onto our monarchical indoctrination. Now, what I mean by the monarchical indoctrination is that a lot of Western religions believe in God as a king or a ruler lording it over its subjects. Now, this goes back, way back, to Darius I in Persia with the King of Kings tradition. And it also goes back to Akhenaten. Well, what Sigmund Freud believes, Akhenaten, he believes that he also had this political analogy of the universe where God is a ruler and a king and we are its slave or subjects. Essentially saying that God has a big ego. So then karma superimposed onto this idea in the West has developed this idea of reward and punishment, because a lot of people who think with monarchical thinking can't get out of the idea of reward and punishment. People are always doing something to benefit themselves. They want a future result to get something good for themselves. So we have this idea of reward and punishment, and karma has become a victim of this reward and punishment tendency, which is why a lot of people think karma literally means cause and effect, which it does not. So when we look over at the East, now you need to keep in mind the East doesn't really have this monarchical indoctrination in the East, because in the East you are part of the divine ground. You are an aspect of that. You are not separate from it. You may not be it in its totality, but deep within you are connected to it. It doesn't rule over you as the gods in a lot of Western religions do. So when we look at karma in the East, karma isn't a yoga of seeking rewards and punishment. Karma is actually about purifying your actions instead of wanting rewards. So the focus is on your actions, about purifying them, making sure that you act authentically and genuinely in society and around the people you know and love. So really there is no good or bad karma. There's just karma, there's just action. Good or bad are only subjective viewpoints, and they also come back to the concepts of reward and punishment, where people will try to do something good to get something good back, or they do unknowingly do something bad and they get something bad back in return. But it's just karma. There is no, in the philosophy of karma in the East, there is no such thing as good or bad karma. There's just karma. So the concept of karma is to train you to always act moral and humble. It's to make your actions moral and to make your personality and your psychology very humble, so that you can become an integral part of the society and you can become an authentic human being. So karma is really about the idea that your life is your own making. So the idea that your actions is what's going to build your life. So you'll see a lot of entrepreneurs kind of follow this philosophy as well, where they try to, in some sense, overly act a lot to build their life a certain way. But they're not wrong in their approach, because the philosophy of karma is your life is your own making. Now, we need to keep in mind that this view of life as your own making is divided between two of the great Hindu philosophies and the oldest ones coming out of India, which is Vedanta and classical yoga. Their views are different on this. Now, to explain this, when we look at classical yoga, it's a dualistic philosophy, meaning that nature, Prakriti, which includes your persona system, your mind, is separate from your innate self, from your transcendental self within yourself, which is known in yoga philosophy as Purusha. Now, because of this dualistic philosophy, your innate self, your pure awareness, is always, if it acts authentically, it'll contribute to, you know, a better life in the outside world. Now, This dualistic philosophy of yoga differs from Vedanta because Vedanta is a non-dual philosophy, which means that the self, so the innate self, the transcendental self, which in yoga they call Purusha and in Vedanta they call Atman, is identical with the Godhead, the all, the everything, the universal matrix, which in Sanskrit is called Brahman. So in Vedanta, the Atman within you is deep, is connected to the Brahman. So your deep down transcendental self beneath your personality is connected to Brahman. So why this is important and why this differs between life as your own making is because yoga, yoga itself emphasizes life as your own making, while Vedanta does somewhat as well. You know, we need to remember that, but it's based on predeterminism. So in yoga, you have, you know, life as your own making, and they don't think things are predetermined. They think that your actions are going to contribute to your life, and if you don't act, nothing's going to happen in the future for you. Vedanta, they say action's still a part of it, but everything is still predetermined. Now, that may seem confusing, but the great 20th century sage Sri Ramana Maharishi, he articulates these Vedantic sentiments in a short note he wrote to his mother when his mother was trying to get him to come out of his self-imposed silence. And Ramana simply wrote, "The ordainer controls the fate of souls in accordance with their Prarabdha karma." Now, Prarabdha karma means personal predestined karma. "Whatever is destined not to happen will not happen, try as you may. Whatever is destined to happen will happen, do what you may to prevent it. This is certain, the best course, therefore, is to remain silent." So Ramana kind of articulates this paradox of life is your own making, but also predeterminism, where you still have Prarabdha karma within Vedanta. So you still have, it's a predestined karma, you could say. So life is still your own making, but at the same time, it is predetermined, all right? So to understand the philosophy of karma more, we need to go back into the origins of karma. Now, the origins of karma are born in one of the more classic texts coming out of India, known as the Bhagavad Gita. Now, the Bhagavad Gita is a small part of the epic, the Mahabharata. Now, the Bhagavad Gita is actually a conversation between the God-man Krishna, who is thought to be an incarnation of Lord Vishnu, and the prince Arjuna. Now, Krishna is trying to get Arjuna to go into war against his friends and his family. He's trying to say to Arjuna, you need to act selflessly. You need to go into war without thinking about it. You yourself, Arjuna, have to downregulate your personality. Now, this war took place in the Kurukshetra region, which is the Gangetic plain around Delhi, around modern Delhi. And so Krishna does, in this area, if we want to believe that that's really where it happened, or if the story is true, Krishna does compel Arjuna to go into this war, and he teaches this wisdom of karma. Now, in the Bhagavad Gita, there's actually three paths in the Bhagavad Gita, which are three of the, probably the core of all of the paths of yoga that we find in India, which is karma, so the yoga of selfless action, bhakti, the yoga of devotion or love for God, and jnana, the yoga of wisdom. And some people believe jnana is the pinnacle of these paths. You want to embody jnana after following these certain paths. You could follow bhakti or you could follow karma. Now, the Bhagavad Gita is part of one third of the core texts of Vedanta as well, of Vedanta philosophy. So we had this war, and karma is one of the key elements, and this is actually the origins of karma in the Bhagavad Gita. And to understand this idea of action in the Bhagavad Gita, we need to dissect two words, which might confuse a lot of people who are familiar with Sanskrit and who are not. First, there are two words in Sanskrit which both mean action. There is karma and there's kriya. Now, kriya or kriya yoga, the path of kriya yoga, is found in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. Okay, it's not found in the Bhagavad Gita. Now, Kriya itself, or Kriya Yoga, is the ecstatic identification with the self, or with the Purusha, or the Atman, which is supposed to eliminate all samskaras within us. Samskaras meaning subliminal imprints or mental impressions or our karmic stock within us at our base, at our subconscious level. So basically the person or the persona system with all of this karma, all of these accumulated karma has disappeared. This is the concept of Kriya in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. The opposite part of action, which is karma, which is found in the Bhagavad Gita, is very different to this. Karma is actually the inaction in action. That's why I say it's the yoga of selfless action. Yoga is the inaction in action. So that may seem confusing. Now, to explain that, in the Bhagavad Gita, there's a key term, which is nishkarma karma. Now, nishkarma karma actually means not being attached to the fruit of your action. Now, this is what Krishna is trying to teach Arjuna. He's trying to teach Arjuna not to be attached to the fruit of his action. He wants him to act just spontaneously and just to act in accord with what is needed, as opposed to what he thinks is needed, or to try and get him out of seeing that they're his family and his friends. He needs him to just act his duty. And Arjuna's duty was from the warrior caste, the Kshatriya. He was from this caste. So his duty in terms of the Hindu caste system was to be a warrior. So he wanted him to fulfill his duty without thinking about too much about it. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna states to Arjuna, "To action alone hast thou a right, and never at all to its fruits. Let not the fruits of action be thy motive, neither let there be in thee any attachment to inaction. Fixed in yoga, do thy work, O winner of wealth Arjuna, abandoning attachment with an even mind in success and failure, for evenness of mind is called yoga." So he's trying to compel him to have this evenness of mind, not to be disturbed by the fluctuations of life, of the external life that's being imposed upon himself. So this idea of nishkarma karma this kind of selfless action, this effortless action. So this is related also to the Taoist philosophy of Uwe. Uwe means non-doing, non-force, effortless action, intelligent spontaneity. And it's a key concept within the Warring States period of China, not only within Taoism, but also within Confucianism and other great sages of that time. And so this nishkarma karma, this Uwe perspective, is also the ultimate goal of Neo-Confucianism. So you have this kind of perspective in the East of selfless action, of not thinking about things, but acting instead of thinking. So basically what you do what is needed without having to think about it. So this is a very Zen approach. You act spontaneously without having to think about it. So what this means is the sense, when you begin to act like this, the sense of the person is beginning to thin away. They're not seeing things partially. They're beginning to see reality in it from an impartial perspective. So in saying that, a lot of you may be asking, okay, so how do we practice karma yoga in the hope of eliminating our karma? Now, eliminating your karma is kind of the wrong way to say it. That's kind of something that we've learned in the modern world, where, you know, that's your karma, we have all of these things. Now, explain why that's right when I explain a lot of the Eastern psychology. So basically, when we look at karma yoga, its practice, and the idea of eliminating our karma, the goal is to actually transform our karma and ultimately transcend it. Now, what that means to transform it and to transcend it means we need to understand what drives our karma. What is it that actually drives our karma? Because if karma is only action and we're going around acting unconsciously all the time, then we're just going to be accumulating a lot more karma. So we need to understand what actually drives it. So to understand what drives it, we need to understand one of the great sciences of the East. Now, this is, it's been around obviously for thousands of years, but not many people think about it. And this is Eastern psychology. So in my book, Fasting the Mind, I talk about this a lot, where I explain this Eastern science, this Eastern psychology, in the perspective of the Wheel of Samsara framework. Now, samsara is a word which means a cycle, or, you know, you live life after life after life without exploring or revealing your own karma. Samsara is this cycle that we go through within our life and also life to life. Now, this Wheel of Samsara framework is made up of three parts of this psychological approach in the East. First, there's karma, so there's action, so your ability to act. Then there's vasanas. Now, vasanas are the habitual patterns or tendencies within our mind that we continually unfold in the world. We don't think about it, we just act that way. So the vasanas drive our karma, drive our action. These habits drive our action. And then the third part, which is the key part, especially when we're talking about transforming or even transcending our karma, is samskaras. Now, samskaras, as I mentioned before, is mental impressions or subliminal activators or imprints. So you can think of samskaras actually as the power base of your being, of your subconscious. This is where all of the karmic stock is stored. So everything you have, all of the karma you have accumulated, is actually within your samskaras. Now, your samskaras as the power base fuel your vasanas, and your vasanas fuel your karma. So you have this process. Now, to get down into your karmic stock is a difficult process, because it requires a complete transformation of yourself, of every aspect of you, your persona, your habits, your actions, all of these things. Because you need to realize that your samskaras fuel your karma, and your karma in most sense are unconscious actions. They're just, you're acting unconsciously and your actions are not very conscious. And this is because all of this karmic stock that we've accumulated within this life and maybe in a past life and other lives. So to counter this, we need to look at the tools and methods of the East to understand our deep subconscious level. So the tools of transformations are actually to transform our karma, vasana, samskaras. There's actually two key tools. One is vairagya. Now, vairagya means non-reaction or dispassion. And the other is viveka. Viveka means discrimination, discernment. And that means the discrimination and discernment within your mind. Seeing your habit patterns or your thoughts or your subconscious bubbles that bubble up into your mind, the ability to actually see them objectively and understand that if I act on that, that's not going to produce good action, good karma, or not going to produce, I should say, beneficial karma. So these are part of the fasting the mind techniques, the ability to fast your mind to get down into the samskara level. So with vairagya, for example, if there was a beautiful piece of chocolate cake there, and you're looking at the chocolate cake, and most of us are addicted to sugar because of our evolutionary process of seeking sugar, we just look at it and go, I'm just going to eat that because it's a chocolate cake. The practice of vairagya would be non-reaction, be able to observe that and say, I'm not going to have it. First of all, it's not good for my health. And second of all, I'm practicing vairagya. I'm practicing the ability to get down into my samskara level. So you're training your action. You see, you're training your action. Your actions actually have to be trained. Your karma has to be trained. Now, this is how we get back into our samskara framework. We can't just look into our samskaras. They're at the subconscious level. The way we get back into them is we transform our actions, which has an effect on our habits, on our habit patterns and tendencies, which then starts to eat away at that deep embedded karmic stock within our samskaras. Okay, so vairagya, first of all, has the ability to do that. So we're not, okay, that person's being arrogant towards me, but I'm not going to unconsciously act angry or or attack them in a certain way. I'm just going to observe it. I'm going to act objectively in this moment, which is going to have an effect on that karmic pull that I usually just act out. Now, vairagya only works at its best with viveka, which I mentioned, discernment or discrimination within your mind, because you're starting to look at the vasana level, the habits. You're starting to look at the habits within yourself, okay? So one habit in a certain situation may be anger. Okay, usually when this person says this particular thing, I just explode in rage. Now, it's difficult to go way back into our life and to find out what actually was the root cause of that, or even if it was a past life thing. But the only way that you can address it is if you begin to use these tools. So viveka on the vasana level actually has a massive effect. So when you're applying vairagya and viveka, then your unconscious actions, your karma, is being transformed, and your habit patterns and your latent tendencies begin to be transformed as well. You start to act differently and people start to think you're weird. Well, he's acting differently. Usually he's angry in the situation. I'm trying to piss him off, but nothing's happening. So this is great. This is a evolution within yourself if you begin to practice these tools. Now, other meditative methods to get into the samskaras and to eliminate some of this karmic stock that you have within yourself is the practice of anapanasati, a Pali word, which actually means awareness of respiration or awareness of breathing. Just the practice of being aware of your respiration more often than not during the day is beginning to, the idea in the East is it's beginning to dig down into your samskaras, because it's actually training you on a very deep level not to act from what's bubbling up within your mind. You're just focusing on breathing. I know that may seem boring to most, but the more you do it, the more it has a deep effect within your samskara level. And you know, if you go to a Buddhist monastery or an ashram, a Hindu ashram in India, there is this constant practice of anapanasati, this constant practice of awareness of the breath, even in walking. That's why they call it walking meditation. You are just feeling the ground step by step, but you're following your breath all the way. And the more you do that, the more you get down into that subtle level. Now that subtle level, it corresponds to another method, and this corresponds to a word called vedana in Pali, which actually means sensations. So the practice of becoming aware of your sensations, your vedana, is to learn to observe them at the root level. Now the idea, now this is an idea in Vipassana, one of the ancient meditative techniques from Gautama the Buddha, which Vipassana means insight into the nature of reality, is that when you get down to that level, that vedana level, when you're observing just the sensations within your psychosomatic organism, you are at the base level of where the body and the mind are connected, at the base level. So where those sensations that drive, those sensations are actually, that drive your actions, are actually on the samskara level. This is part of the technology, okay? So those sensations, when you feel it, because all you're doing, when you are angry, you are just feeling a sensation within yourself. When you're happy, you're feeling a sensation within yourself. So if you want to transform samskaras on the deep level, you need to get down to that sensational level, down to the sensorium, as I say, the vedana level. And the more you become aware of that, the more you become aware of those samskaras that are shooting up from that subconscious base within ourselves and are compelling us to act. So this is a beautiful method, I believe. And these tools and methods allow you to remain as the transcendental self more purely and for longer periods without the subconscious bubbles of samskaras rising to the surface within the conscious mind. Okay, so the transcendental self being the Atman or the Purusha, the deep down essence of you, the real you, the you which is connected to the Brahman. So all of these tools and methods, like I said, are there for you to remain as that for longer, which when you remain that for longer, you can begin to observe these samskara sensations, these bubbles that rise to the conscious mind, and you can begin to transform them and eventually transcend them. Now, the approach in Vedanta is very similar to that, because in Vedanta, they would say the more you remain as the self, this is good enough. Because when you remain as Atman more often, or you remain as that transcendental self, this is actually sufficient enough, according to them, to burn out all samskaras within ourselves. Now, when we look at that perspective, the Vedanta perspective, that's pretty similar with most Eastern perspectives within monasteries and ashrams and other sacred places around Asia. Because when we look at that, the people, for example, who have gone into these places, into a monastery, so that they've renounced the world for a bit, for maybe for life, and they've gone into a monastery, they're focusing just on that. And so when you, and I've met many Buddhists and Hindus and that, and they have this certain glow about them, the ones who have actually practiced for long periods of time have this certain glow about them, because the samskaras themselves have actually been burnt out. And you know, I know, for example, a few sadhus in the town of Tiruvannamalai around Arunachala, the holy mountain of Arunachala, and you can notice within the eyes of some of these sadhus that the samskaras themselves are not there anymore. The karmic stock has been released, and these people are very open, and their eyes are very awake, you could say. So once you employ either system of the Vedanta approach or the tools that I've mentioned, the persona system begins to thin away. That's the idea. That's the main idea. The main idea, obviously, when we approach karma, is that we need to understand what aspect of ourselves accumulates karma. Is it the Atman, the Purusha, the transcendental self? Of course not, because it's pure, it's non-dual. It cannot accumulate anything. It's stainless. It's only the persona system, only the person who can accumulate karma. So when the persona system or the person within you begins to thin away, you still continue to act even though you have transcended karma. So you still act. You still are out here doing action. You are being the actor in this play, you could say. But you have, in a sense, transcended action, because you have employed these systems and the persona has thinned away. Now, what does that mean? Like what I said, karma is linked only to the person. And karma exists in time. It doesn't exist out of time. It's something that we accumulate through the process of living life after life. And the person, the persona, is what? Is a time-bound instrument. The idea of Jason only exists because of the things I've accumulated through my life, which makes my personality, makes my character. So when the person begins to disappear, all that's left is the transcendental self, the non-dual self, that which is in me, which is the same within you and within everything. That's all that's left. And that's the end of the cycle. That's the end of karma. That's the end of all of that karmic stock within your samskaras. Now, this relates also to reincarnation. When we look at the concept of reincarnation, what reincarnates? Jason doesn't reincarnate. What reincarnates is that karmic stock within the samskaras. Now, that is taken over from this life to the next, if it's not burnt out, to the next, to the next, to the next, until I'm fed up with the game. So in the East, when you're completely fed up, you make the statement that this is my last life. I am willing to transcend and transform and transcend all of this karmic stock within me. I am willing to eliminate the samskaras within me that continue to make this person that lives life after life. That's the process of karma yoga. And that's really what karma is. So I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I hope you learned a lot about what karma is. Now it's up to you to decide, is this going to be your last life? See you again next time.